This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com. This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Donna Adelson, her trial is beginning. By the time you're watching this, it will probably already be underway. And we're going to discuss the dynamics of it, the foundation of it, where it is right now as opening statements are about to begin, or like I said, may have already been done, and where this thing is going from what we know, from what they've already said they're planning to do. Joining me to discuss, Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries. It's been interesting thus far as of our recording. They're still in jury selection. The voir dire is going on. And you found that very interesting. Let's start there and talk about that a little bit. What have you gleaned off of this? And for those not familiar with what all that is, it's them picking their jurors of who's going to be on the panel. What have you seen so far?
It's really interesting because a lot of times they don't stream voir dire, and especially in high profile cases where they're super conscious about not in any way giving any kind of inclination to us, the general public, like who the jurors are, because they're always worried about, you know, jury tampering. So, so for this case, I was really excited to see it. And frankly, it's the most important part of any trial. I mean, picking your jury is everything. It's like, you know, people tend to think, oh, the cross-examinations and the introduction of evidence, that's all obviously very important. But picking those 12 people, as far as the attorneys go, that is the most critical portion of the trial. I mean, they are the ones who are making the decision as to innocence or guilt, or not guilty or guilty. So, you know, for us to be able to watch it and kind of see what that process is, I love. And it was kind of like, you know, for years I was telling people, especially when I was just doing my podcast before the YouTube channel, look, the real war, the real battles are fought prior to trial, where you have the motions that are trying to keep evidence in, trying to put evidence in, trying to keep it out, you know, things of that nature, because that ultimately determines what the jurors are going to hear when it goes to trial. And you'll see cases where, you know, critical evidence is kept out, you know, that the jury will never hear about, that we have the opportunity to watch it get litigated. And they never used to stream that. And now it's commonplace. Like, we all are streaming all these pretrial hearings, which are fabulous. I mean, they're really fascinating to watch. And it really gives you a much deeper understanding of how this process works. Because trial is like the end game. You know, it's like there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes on. And it also lets people understand why it takes these cases so long to get to trial sometimes. So to see this kind of part of the process where we typically don't get to see it is so instructive for people that love to watch trials and are true crime fanatics and love to watch these things develop. Like, being able to see how lawyers go about picking these jurors is really a fascinating thing. And this is especially fascinating because, you know, we had Judge Everett, who's a phenomenal judge on this case. You know, he asks a bunch of questions, just kind of like trying to weed out people that you know, may have issues that won't allow them to be able to sit on a 3-week jury. You know, so they're able to thin the herd a bit. before they get to when the lawyers ask the questions, which they call voir dire. And, you know, so that happened. And then we've seen Georgia Kappelman, that's who we were watching this morning, who's the prosecuting attorney and who knows this case forward and backwards. She's prosecuted all of the other cases associated with this case. So, and her questions have been fascinating, you know, mm-hmm. and I was streaming with Allie, my partner, and, you know, we were talking about the fact that she was really kind of digging into the law and whether or not people had an understanding of the law. And it was just, it's a really, really fascinating process to watch. And it really kind of goes to the heart of how hard it is to pick jurors, mm-hmm. you know, because you're trying, you have very limited information about these people. These are going to be the people that are going to be sitting in that box, listening to everything intently for all these weeks, and they're ultimately the decision makers. So you want to have as much knowledge about that person as you can possibly get prior to having them sit on that jury. You want to know mm-hmm. if they have biases.
Sure.
You know, because really both sides want an unbiased juror. You know, you want them coming in just kind of as a unformed
yeah.
piece of clay that is going to just listen to it. And most importantly, follow the law, no matter if they have a bias, mm-hmm. are they going to be able to put that aside and follow what the law dictates that they do?
The fact that we're able to see this in this case, and a lot of the cases still don't run this, we're not able to see it. Right. Would you say that having this more out in the open, does that put, I mean, not that there's unscrupulous things going on, but more eyeballs on it, the public watching this, more pressure there to make sure that the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, essentially, so that at the end of the day, it's not something that happened behind closed doors and could be questioned. Obviously, you know, there is a record of these sort of things, but just the fact that you have all these other people watching it, does that change the dynamics at all of a trial and the process of the trial when you have the general public viewing in as well, beyond just the normal folks who would be in the courtroom?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I mean, I'm all for it. I'm big on transparency in courts. I mean, the Constitution calls for public trials. And, you know, back when they drafted that thing, that just meant that people could come into the courtroom and watch it, mm-hmm. right?
Sure.
Because none of this technology existed. So, you know, the ability for all of us, should we so choose, to watch it is fantastic. However, with that comes some risk, you know, and it's the things that you were talking about. You know, you don't want the public being able to sway jurors, whether they're impaneled or not. Like if they haven't sequestered jurors, and if you've got a juror that's not following the rules and not accessing their social media, I mean, because when you think about it, Tony, I mean, how difficult would it be to avoid everything related to that case with respect to our access to phones, if we're on our computer and, you know, like we get notifications popping up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really, really hard in a high profile case, especially if you're geolocated in the area where it's happening,
yeah.
to avoid getting any kind of outside information about that trial that you're sitting as a juror on.
Sure.
So, I mean, yeah, there's risks involved with it. You know, I mean, so you have to kind of balance, is there ever going to be a point where we make trials where they're not public? I mean, the answer to that has to be no, because mm-hmm. the reason they're public is for that transparency. We need to know what our government is doing. We need to be able to watch and monitor and hold them accountable for you know, what they're doing. And if you don't have public trials, if they say, okay, well, social media has just gotten out of hand, like there's no way that we can keep these people in the dark. You know, we yeah. can't sequester them in a hotel for a month and take everything away from them. It's just such a hardship that it's going to shrink the pool of prospective jurors, because people are going to be like, I can't be out of touch from reality for that long. I just can't do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to try to figure out ways to kind of balance it. But, you know, as far as the need for us to be able to keep our eye on what's going on in our courts is just absolute. And we can't, you know, we can never have that go away, because then we become a very, very scary country, because the government at that point can try everything in the dark. And yeah. We have no idea what's going on, and no one wants to live in a country like that.
Well, and it's very much up to the judge most of the time as to if these things are going to be held in the dark. I mean, look at Delphi. That one was held in the dark. And then you have other ones that are in full light, like Donna Adelson here. Is this something?
Florida is great about that, though, T. Yeah. Like Florida, you know, that's the sunshine state, has sunshine laws that they're letting everybody see everything, you know, I'm a fan of.
Do you think we're going to see more of that just with the way the public is demanding it? And I mean, obviously, it's good to have sunlight on this and people to be able to see what's going on and more eyes on the ball. So if something does go wrong, people can go, hey, this needs to be looked at here. Are we going to see more transparency or are we going to see the opposite and more pullbacks from the court systems? Obviously, it's kind of state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction because of that very thing, because they fear too many eyes are on this. And we like running things the way we run things.
Yeah. I mean, they have that option like New York State just will not allow cameras in the courtroom. And, you know, obviously there's some pretty big time cases going on, namely, you know, the upcoming Huerman trial. And that's going to be a case that's going to garner a lot of attention and people are going to want to see what's going on with it. But New York has been steadfast. I mean, Illinois, we're the same way. We really like they're allowed in the courtroom and judges can't allow for it to happen, but it just doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, like, and technically, as long as they're not closing the courtroom, they're abiding by the Constitution because the public can come. They're just saying, hey, if you want to watch this thing, you got to come down to the courthouse and watch it.
Show up on your horse.
Yeah. So I don't know, man. I frankly, I'd love to see everything streamed.
Sure.
I mean, obviously we have the technology for it and there's cases going on all over the place because the other part of it is if like mainstream media has not decided to crown a case worthy of our attention, then we're not hearing anything about it.
True.
And there's cases all over this country going on all of the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're kind of left to the discretion of whoever is streaming the trials, namely court TV and Law and Crime these days, in terms of what we're seeing, you know? So obviously they focus on states that are very free with, you know, the streaming and allowing it to happen. So they typically focus on cases. That's why oftentimes we're seeing cases from the same states on Law and Crime and court TV, because they're knowing that they're not going to have an issue with it.
True.
So that's why we see a lot of, like we saw all the Idaho cases. Mm-hmm. We see the Arizona cases. We see Iowa cases. You know, we see Florida cases a ton. You know, but there's a lot of other states with a lot of stuff going on, and we just have no idea what's happening. So, I mean, it just depends, man. It depends on the states. And, you know, I can see a solid argument as to the potential pratfalls with it, what we were talking about before with just social media and YouTube and all that stuff and how it is impacting trials. I mean, there's no question that it's impacting trials. I mean, we saw it with Reed. Mm-hmm. We saw it less with Delphi, but you know, I mean, you could argue that was mitigated by the fact that Gull tried the thing in the dark.
If there's nothing for the villagers to watch, there's going to be less interest and less action that they're going to take.
Exactly.
And the courts use that to their advantage. Let's talk more about the Donna Adelson trial, as obviously it's getting underway. From your vantage point, how unusual is it for a case like this to stretch 11 years before the matriarch is finally brought to trial? Obviously, we saw the hitman, we saw McBona, we saw Charlie, and now finally Donna. What's your thoughts that it took this long to finally get to Donna?
It's crazy. It's crazy that it's been going on that long. And it's probably the most interesting question that, because Georgia Kappelman asked a lot of really fascinating questions during the voir dire, but there was one particular prospective juror and she asked, oh, I see that you're 20 years old. She's like, so that means when this all happened, that you were 9 years old. Do you care about anything that might have happened when you were 9 years old?
Like, I mean, think about that. Yes. Like, it was a great question to ask, and it was like I was dying to hear the answer.
She's just slightly older than Wendy's kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I mean, the closest thing that we see these days to something like this, where it's just kind of so many different defendants, and they have to obviously take some time in between trying them, and they're hoping that they can get, like, especially with a case like Donna's, where they had to kind of lock in these convictions, mm-hmm. get some testimony on the stand, get some sworn testimony on the stand so that they had enough to bring a case against Donna. They had to kind of build the case against Donna mm-hmm. by having the other trials take place. So, because like the other thing that we see where it may be a case where it happened a long time ago is where they finally solve a cold case, mm-hmm. you know, where it may have happened 15, 20 years ago. Technology in terms of DNA has allowed them to make an arrest, and now they're going to trial on something that happened forever ago. I mean, we've seen a few of those in recent memory, but you know, yeah, this in terms of this type of thing where there's this many players and they're trying them one after another over a period of a decade. Mm-hmm. It's really, really unusual and like fascinating.
Kind of like two questions here. Obviously, prosecutors are framing Donna kind of as the last piece of the puzzle here. My first question, and we'll go with it, is she the last piece of the puzzle? Or is she just the latest piece of the puzzle as we saw them kind of work their way through to Charlie eventually? And then now we're to Donna. Is there another domino that's going to fall here? Or do you think that the road ends with Donna?
Man, I mean, if you were a fly on the wall in Georgia Kappelman's house, you know that with all of her being, every fiber of it, she wants to get Wendy. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think there's any part of Georgia Kappelman that believes that Wendy did not have a hand in this. I mean, it was her kids.
Yeah.
Dan was her ex-husband. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's impossible for most people to believe that Grandma Gotti, that Donna was the one who really orchestrated all this, shy of not having any input with Wendy, that she was so hell-bent on having her grandchildren around her, like in her old age, because it was that important to her that she orchestrated this shit without Wendy having any knowledge of it.
Yeah.
It's kind of a hard thing to buy, but at the end of the day, a prosecutor is not going to move forward on a case unless they believe that they have enough evidence to get the win, to get the conviction. And that's the million-dollar question. That's what I was saying. Like, George is still hoping that something comes out at this trial that helps her move towards maybe even Harvey. You know?
That's another domino, too. But I'm wondering, what do you think Georgia is betting on something happening here? Or is it just kind of a hope that maybe something slips out, something is said the wrong way? Or do you think that there may be a direction here? There may be a strategy of, we're going to go this way on Donna, and maybe by doing that, it's going to, you know, squirt some information out of here, out of her mouth, that's going to lead us to give us enough to pull the rug out from under Wendy or Harvey possibly.
Yeah, I think it's probably the latter, because I think that Georgia is of the mindset that Donna's going to testify. Charlie mm-hmm. testified his own trial. I think Donna's going to have to try. As much as defense attorneys abhor putting their clients on the stand, and it's not related to innocence or guilt at all, it's related to the fact that when you get on that stand, if the jury doesn't like you, It really works against you. If your client gets up there and says something that could be construed in multiple ways, that can really hurt you. I mean, it's way easier for them to get up on the stand and make a mistake or be seen in a certain way by the jury that results in a conviction, that it's much safer just to keep them off the stand and make the state meet their burden.
Yeah.
So in this case, I think that Georgia's of the mindset, look, Donna's going to get on that stand and maybe she says something.
Yeah.
Maybe she slips up and says something that allows us to go after Wendy. And I think that the other part of it, in terms of the long-term strategy that Georgia has taken on these cases, is, you know, pressure makes diamonds. You know, like, she starts with Charlie and now she goes after the matriarch. And is it going to be a situation where if Wendy was involved, if Wendy was in the know, if Wendy had a hand in it, and both of them go down and they start resenting the fact that Wendy's out there living her best life while they're both rotting in prison for the rest of their lives, that one of them decides to turn state's evidence and testify against Wendy. I mean, you can't discount that. You can't discount that. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
And think about if you're Georgia and you get a conviction on Donna and then you go after Harvey, because Harvey, there's some interesting stuff that came out during Charlie's trial about how Harvey was the beneficiary of this birthday gift. And the birthday gift was going to be Dan Markell's death, which was resulting in his grandchildren being with him in his old age. So that came out in that trial. So there's some smoke there.
Yeah.
Now, if you're Donna and you're Charlie and you see that George is going to go after Harvey, does that put Donna in a position where if she's like, I orchestrated this whole thing. I can't have the love of my life, my life partner, my mm-hmm. soulmate. I can't have him go down for this. And does that have her come forward? Not so much to help Harvey, but to go to Kappelman and say, all right, I'm going to give you what you need. Harvey didn't have shit to do with this. I'm going to give up Wendy. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there's so many different ways that Georgia can play this to try to create the amount of pressure to get one or both of them to talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's really a fascinating case, man. There's just so many tentacles.
There is. I mean, you got to dig into this and like absorb it for a couple days to kind of make sense of it. And we've been in it for 100%. A while now, but it was a very confusing one when I first started learning about it. Let's talk about, if Wendy were to testify, obviously there's already been some scuttlebutt about that, where she was trying to be subpoenaed by the defense of Donna Adelson. Her own attorneys came back and said, no, you're not going to do that. Give me some insight on this as a defense attorney, because on the outside, you're looking at it going, is there trouble in the enmeshed family paradise of the Adelsons? Or is this part of their strategy? How do you read that?
She's definitely going to testify. She's testified in all the trials.
Yeah.
So they give her an immunity deal. She's got use and, I believe, derivative use immunity, which essentially means use immunity. Immunity is when you testify in court on behalf of the Commonwealth or the state, and they cannot use what you testify to at trial against you to try you down the road. Mm-hmm. Okay. Derivative use immunity means that if information she testifies to at trial then causes them to go out and investigate based solely on what she said, and they're able to secure evidence from that, they can't use that either. That's derivative use. It's derived mm-hmm. from her testimony. So she doesn't have full immunity.
Yeah.
So she does have those two. So from that perspective, fully expect to see Wendy on the stand again. And in this situation, what you had was defense counsel was trying to subpoena her so that they could call her. Mm-hmm. Now, the strategy behind that is unknown, because it goes to what you were saying. Is there some kind of crack
yeah.
where they could try to like really try to, you know, like widen the gap a little bit and get Wendy to say something that helps Donna? I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but ultimately the judge ruled, look, you're going to have an opportunity to cross her. You know, that's all you're going to get. I'm not allowing you to subpoena and call her in your case in chief. Cause that was the thing. Mm-hmm. They really wanted to be able to call Wendy during their case in chief so that they could direct examine her, leaving her the ability to have more open-ended answers, because the difference between direct and cross is very narrowly tailored to where you're asking questions which theoretically should be answered with a yes or a no.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're not, like typically during a good cross-examination, you're not leaving the ability for that person that's on the stand to go through long narrative type
yeah.
answers. Because you want to be able to control the flow of that. Whereas with a direct, you're allowing those long narrative answers. And I think from the defense's perspective, they view Wendy as helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. And they view Wendy as being able to get on the stand on direct and say, all right, well, Wendy, tell us why you know for a fact that your mother had no hand in this. Yeah. And then she goes through some long diatribe because like that question, you're not going to be able to get on cross. You know what I'm saying? So
helpful it's a to very Donna, different thing. Helpful to Donna, but right. not Wendy being helpful to Wendy. Right. And so, I mean, essentially what you have here, you know, if you're looking at the Adelsons in just kind of a real simplistic look at this, this is Donna saying, Wendy, it's time for you to go on stage. Make mama proud. Make mama happy. Big smiles. And Wendy's right. like, no, I'm not going. I don't want to go up there right now. Like, whatever. Right. If I screw up, if I sing the wrong note, I'm going to get in trouble. But make right. mama proud. Go make right. mama happy. And yeah. she ain't making mama happy here.
That's exactly right. And, yeah. and, you know, and it was Wendy's attorney who filed the motion to quash it.
Yes.
So like that's significant. And it goes to exactly what you're saying. Love you. You know, it goes to exactly what you're saying with respect to whether or not Wendy is going to testify and if she's going to be helpful to her mother
yeah.
from that. You know, you could take it a couple of ways. One, the way that you took it, mm-hmm. like, no, I'm not willing to do that. I might slip up,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
which is that thing. Or, you know, it could be that they just, you know, because what they said is that if they were to subpoena her, they being the defense, that she would just take the fifth.
Yeah.
All time. So, I mean, you can read a lot into that because the defense cannot give her immunity. That's mm-hmm. not within their power. So when she gets up there, she's fully exposed.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
why the defense is like, no, 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 no. We're not willing to do that. There's just too many like pratfalls. There's too yeah. many areas where Wendy can get caught up. If they get into the whole thing where Wendy just so happens to drive by the murder scene right at the time or right after the time, you know, Dan's shot and killed in his garage. And, you know, she's allegedly on her way to a liquor store. You know, I mean,
that's what makes it even more classic.
Dude, it's sticky.
You're going to the liquor store.
Yeah, it's I don't
blame her. I mean, especially if she really, truly has nothing to do with this. If she just has this crazy family and she like she suspects they might be capable of doing this, but doesn't really think they'd ever do it. And then finds out, oh, my God, they just did it. I think my stop would be the liquor store, too.
100%. And, dude, look, I don't know if you've read and you should. If you haven't, you should read the emails from Donna to Wendy during the litigation, during the custody fight for the kids. Like these emails from Donna to Wendy, and I have not seen, I don't know if they're public. Mm-hmm. I have not seen Wendy's responses, mm-hmm. but like you really get a sense of who Donna was and just how much of a matriarch that yeah. ran that family with an iron fist really is.
Yeah.
Like you, it's like it's her telling her this is what you need to do, that thing where you were talking about, you know, hey, it's time to put on your, that's exactly the shit that she was telling her in the email. She's like, you need to get up there and this is how you need to handle it. You need to go up there and threaten that we're going to, you know, I'm going to send the kids to Catholic school.
Yeah.
You know, like all these manipulative things that she was trying to get to have Dan like pop off
yeah.
and put him in a position where, or have him settle, mm-hmm. you know, and it also shows that we're gathering up a huge amount of money. We're looking to offer Dan $1 million to allow him or to have him allow the kids move down to us, you know? So it's like, you really see just the grasp that this woman had over her grown children who are, mm-hmm. you know, you've got Charlie, who's a dentist,
yeah.
and you've got Wendy, who's an attorney, and you've got this mom
yeah,
that
I mean,
is just
I mean, look
running
at,
shit.
Look at the, some of Wendy's testimony in the past where it's like, would you call your mom controlling? Well, I don't know. And it's like you're looking at like a 13-year-old girl there. I don't know if I call her that. Like, yeah, I guess.
Right.
Like
right.
it's some silly thing. Like your ex-husband's dead. The father of your kids are dead. And you still can't quite see what the hell your mom is up to or like the type of woman that she seems to be. Take murder yeah. out of the equation. Just look at the kind of woman that she is, what she was wanting to do, how she was trying to manipulate people.
Right.
Like that in itself is quite spooky.
It's spooky yeah. and telling.
Yeah. Oh, very.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, yeah. it really, really shines a light on just who Donna is. And they were fighting to keep those emails out. And believe me, they're coming in.
Yeah.
You know, because it really goes to the heart of the matter here. You know, in order to get a jury on a strictly circumstantial case to buy into this concept that this sweet old lady who's 75 years old sitting there in her cardigan and looking her hair a mess. Like,
I know.
You know, it's like, dude, you know, it's
that
like,
answered
okay.
That today. We right, saw Donna like cardiganing it up and not the same Donna.
No, not the same Donna. And so they're going to bring this evidence in to say, okay, you know, this act, the shit that she's pulling right here in the courtroom, the sweet old grandmother thing, that ain't her.
Yeah.
This woman is a ruthless gangster. And she went to any means necessary to get her grandchild. Because at the end of the day, Tony, this case really boils down to that this woman wanted to have her grandchildren within a stone's throw of her. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, because like the argument in terms of was Wendy involved against that concept is that, look, Wendy probably wanted to be as far away from her mother as humanly possible just because she's so up in her ass all the time.
Yeah.
Like she probably loved being 100, 300 miles away from her because that meant that she wasn't like so involved in her life. She's like, I'm a grown woman. My mom is just so involved that I just can't handle it anymore. So I don't know, man. It's a crazy, crazy case, you know, because there's people out there that are just dead set that there's no way that Wendy didn't know about this. And they fully expect that George is going to go after her. And I read those emails for the first time, dude, I'm like, I could see a world in which this woman just was doing shit to get her way. And I'm talking about Donna.
Yeah, exactly. And I can honestly, I just don't know the answer to the Wendy question. And that's why I don't go either way. Cause I just don't know. And I, you know, until there's evidence to show the other way, I don't know. I can very much see exactly what you just said, where Wendy is just passive. That's how she was grown. That's how she grew up. That's how she had to be. Cause Donna was a star and Donna still wanted to get her way. And she still kind of felt this obligation of, well, I gotta kind of make her happy, you know? And at the same point, trying to be independent, and Donna was going to do what Donna was going to do, even if Wendy had objected to this or said, no, let's not kill the kid's dad.
Right.
I'm going to guess Donna was going to do what Donna was going to do. And it didn't make a damn bit of difference if, in fact, you know, Donna is behind this, obviously innocent till proven guilty.
Dude, look. When you think about the long game on this to show you just how short-sighted Donna was, think about the concept of these kids who are now old enough to Google. They are old enough to understand what they're Googling.
They're high school kids.
Dude, like this woman has ruined their lives.
Yeah.
They've destroyed the Adelson name. By all accounts, this was an accomplished, educated, wealthy family that because of Donna's just absolute
narcissism,
unfettered desire and want to have those children near her, she did whatever she wanted to do to make that happen. And the kids were of no consequence. Because she had to have thought at some point, well, what happens if we get busted? Like that thought never entered her mind. What is that going to do to these kids that I'm so desperate to be around? How is that going to affect their lives moving forward?
Because it wasn't ever about the kids. It wasn't about the kids being, oh, this is great. Be close to your family. And it was about Donna being happy, about that feeling for Donna. Not about, hey, let's drag Wendy from her life across the state. Hey, let's take the kids from their father. That's not a bad idea. It's also Donna. Can be close to those
what
kids.
Donna wants, because Donna gets.
Because Donna is number one. Donna shouldn't have even been in those conversations, but Donna inserted herself. But she inserted herself into all of those conversations, you know, on her own volition. So there's a reason there are books about narcissistic mothers and surviving them and trying to, and parents in general. I mean, if you want to understand Donna Adelson, read some of those and you'll go, oh, that's Donna.
100%.
So Charlie's set to come into this, probably even testify as well, correct?
Yep.
And
yep.
What do you think? Obviously, he is still trying to go for an appeal here on his verdict. What do you think Charlie's going to bring or not bring to the table on this?
That's a really, really hard question to answer because of exactly what you just said. The appeal being out there, I mean, it's going to be deny. I don't know how much, Georgia's in that tough position where she's got to put Charlie on as a state's witness. And again, she's stuck direct examining. I think that Judge Everett will give her some leeway mm-hmm. in terms of her questioning and what she can ask. But, you know, she's in that position where she's trying to coax a bad answer out of a witness that she's called, mm-hmm. you know, which is very unusual. You know, typically your witnesses that you're calling in your case in chief are giving you evidence that helps you. And Charlie, she knows, is getting called to the stand is not going to be helpful.
Yeah.
You know, so she's really got to try to trap him into giving him some, you know, to giving her some bad answers for Charlie and for his mother that really help her case. And it's tricky. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like the work that Georgia has to do in order to try to kind of walk through the minefield of getting these convictions on these cases is a sight to behold, really. Because when you think about it, you know, you're bringing both kids up. You've got Charlie and Wendy both testifying. Both are not going to throw mom under the bus. So you're having to try to form questions that you think are going to elicit an answer that there's no way to answer it other than to throw Donna under the bus.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Or you're having him answer a question wherein if he denies it based on everything else the jury has heard, the jury then just realizes he's lying. You know what I'm yeah. saying? So it's like, it's tricky, man.
Tricky. I mean, the jury, obviously there's everything that's going to weigh different ways on a jury as they go into a trial. In this particular scenario and, you know, other scenarios where it's kind of a domino effect, how damaging is that to the defendant this round? Obviously, this one's Donna Adelson. We're four people into this now. The fact that the hitman, McBonna, Charlie, all convicted, all in prison, and now Donna is here being tried. The jury's going to know that it's basically been all these have been taken out saying, yeah, you all have been involved. That's, you know, that's going to, I think, put a little weight, I would think, on that jury and maybe even a little preconceived notion that Donna might have something to hide here.
Yeah. I mean, there's no question about it. It's not optimal.
No.
If you're a defendant that they've tried four other people that they're claiming that, you know, you were in party with in terms of a conspiracy to commit murder, it's like, it's not optimal. Mm-hmm. It like no defense attorney's going to say, yeah, I like no problem. I don't care that they've tried the other four people that were involved or three plus one pled out and got 19 years as the driver. You know, it's like, and it's all coming out. Like it's like every part of that story, like there is no trying Donna without all of the entire story coming out. So that hope that maybe, you know, oh, other bad acts, the 404B evidence isn't going to come in. Not the case. It's all coming in and they're going to hear the whole damn story. And it's as simple for Georgia as saying she's that other piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. So like you have this entire puzzle of the conspiracy and here it is. And I've built it up for you. You see that big gaping hole right there? I'm going to stick this piece right in. And that piece is Donna. You know, she's that part. She's the money.
Yeah.
She's where the cash came from. You know,
her name's on the
check. She's the one who wanted it. Yeah.
So, cat's a kind of a big one to get around. Okay. We were talking earlier, you know, obviously it's usually a last resort that your client, if they're the defendant, is going to go and testify. It's usually decided into the trial. It's not usually a big announcement made prior to the trial actually beginning. It happened before the trial actually began. They started coming out, Donna's going to testify. Yep. What the hell is going on over there?
I mean, when you look at what the evidence they have against Donna and the consciousness of guilt stuff that they have, which is obviously her buying it to, like, after Charlie's convicted, her son, and she buys a one-way ticket with Harvey to Vietnam, which just so happens to be a country where they don't have extradition to the United States.
Just so happens.
And it just so happens. You know, and you've got this situation where you've got all of these recorded phone calls between Charlie and Donna after he's convicted that are very damning. You know, you have those consciousness of guilt pieces of evidence that are coming in. You kind of have to get her up on the stand to testify and explain, well, no, I just, like, Harvey and I love Vietnam. Like, honestly, no one told us that we couldn't leave the country. You know, it's like my child had just been convicted. I was devastated. I needed to go to my happy place, and that happy place for, you know, so like she's got to get up there to try to talk this shit away.
Yeah.
Because frankly, the consciousness of guilt evidence is some of the most powerful evidence they have, mm-hmm. because a lot of the other evidence is basically you've got convicted felons that are testifying with Katie and Luis, mm-hmm. and you know, they're murderers.
Yeah.
Convicted murderers. And Katie lied on the stand during her own trial. So, you know, they have warts. They're not the perfect witnesses, even though they come off as pretty credible, you know, like they're owning it at this point, but still, you know, it's like, I think that the way that the defense feels is that Donna's got to get up there and explain herself.
Do you think this was a decision made by her defense attorneys, or was this a Donna standing up going, well, I'll just go tell. I mean, I can see it being a Donna choice where it's just a Donna, I can handle this. I'm going to do it because that's how she's run her life.
100% a Donna choice, because any decent defense attorney is going to be saying, you know, and ultimately, like, just understand this, it's Donna's choice.
Yeah, it's Donna's choice, but I'm just wondering who came up with the idea early?
And it's Donna.
Okay. Because,
like, what any good defense attorney is going to say, we'll take it by ear.
Yeah.
We'll play it by ear. We'll see how their case goes, and then we'll decide, which still might be the case.
Sure.
Like, I'm assuming that their attorneys are saying, look, I know we're putting it out there that Donna's going to testify. Maybe that's just straight strategy.
Yeah.
To try to make Georgia a little nervous. Like, oh, well, shit. It's not making Georgia nervous. She's like, can't wait for Donna to testify.
Or it could have been giving her more overconfidence as well. Maybe that's part of the strategy there. Make her super confident. Well, Donna's going to testify. You know, not that you're going to do a lesser of a job, but, you know, it may play in your psyche a little bit. Like, well, we got that slam dunk coming too. And if the slam dunk suddenly doesn't happen, it's like, oh, shit, you know?
Right. There's no question. I mean, if you've got that, you know, where the state's relying on it is what they anticipate will be a very powerful piece of evidence for them, which is the defendant's testimony. Yeah, you're right. That could, but Georgia ain't that one, man.
Like, no.
she knows this case forward and backwards. It's been her obsession for the last decade. And like, they're not going to catch her, you know, like off guard. Like she's going to be prepared.
She didn't
no matter
just get
which
the,
way the defense tries to play it. And she's ready.
She didn't just get the gig last week. I'm like, oh, better study up on this.
It's not her first rodeo.
No. The fact that let me ask you this. Do you think Donna can sway a jury? I mean, we've seen her testify in pretrial motions talking about earwax and uncomfortable bedding situations in prison. Kind of Koberger-ish a little bit. But do you think she can get up there and play this act? And obviously, that was a very different crowd. It was not in front of the jury. It was for the judge. It was for her own selfish needs and things of that nature. She's already got the cardigan on. She's already playing old lady. Do you think if they wheeled her up there and then helped her get onto the stand with crutches that she could pull off poor old grandma? And I'm just, my God, I can't believe Charlie got into this big mess over here, and I don't know what happened.
I mean, no more than I thought that Murdoch was going to be able to get on the stand and portray loving father who had, you know, his entire family like destroyed. But in terms of, you know, narcissistic people, you've got two people that absolutely themselves believe that they're going to be able to get on that stand and convince a jury.
Yes.
That's what this boils down to, because ultimately it goes back to the question you just asked me, like, whose idea was it? It was definitely Donna's. Mm-hmm. Donna is, of course, thinking, I'm going to be able to get there on the stand, and I'm going to be able to convince people that there's no way I would have done this. I'm just this wonderful, loving woman who, you know, has been tossed into this mix, and my son didn't have anything to do with it. I didn't have anything to do with it. And they're going to believe me because I'm just that believable.
What advantages, or let's say Donna gets convicted, what advantage is there for Donna or Charlie or anybody to turn on Wendy or to turn on Harvey. I mean, obviously they're family members. I don't think they're like necessarily out to get them, but if they're going to be spending the rest of their life in a box, you know, are they vindictive enough to say, guess what? You're going to join us too, because you were part of this, if they were.
that would require like resentencing.
Yeah.
You know, so like once they're already sentenced, if she's like, all right, well, I'm going to turn state's evidence. I'm going to put Wendy down for you, but you got to give me something. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it could be worked out.
Yeah.
You know, some kind of deal could be worked out for resentencing because of what she was bringing to the table. You know, but that would be completely up to Georgia's discretion as to whether or not she was willing to do that. So, I mean, there could be aspects of it where they could gain a benefit, you know, and that would ultimately probably be the biggest carrot that the state could offer in terms of getting them to do it. But, you know, it could be that thing where, you know, even if they're not offered anything, you know, and to me, it's always like Charlie, who is such the mama's boy, that if Donna gets convicted and Charlie's just sitting in there steaming, you know, like you let mom go down.
Yeah.
Like mom's going down on this shit now. Like, fuck you, Wendy. You know, I'm giving it up. He's like, I'm done with the ruse. You know, it's like more than, because Donna's 75.
Yeah.
You know, and like she could be that, you know, like just so family driven that she's not going to let Wendy go down too. Mm-hmm. You know, so in my mind, that's why I was saying, I think that the more likely scenario where you'd see Donna turn state's evidence would be if they went after Harvey.
Yeah.
You know, I think that like if, especially if Harvey really had no plan or was not a part of like the overall scheme in any significant way, you know, it's like, I mean, you could argue Harvey, you know, was making the money. Harvey had kind of built the wealth, you know, Harvey clearly knew about it, you know, after the fact, you know, so it's like, to me, that squeeze on Harvey would be the more likely scenario wherein you might get Donna to squeal as to Wendy, not as to Harvey though. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like Harvey's like probably a tougher case than Wendy because as far as I know, there's not many communications that they have that are smoking gun type communications that involve Harvey. And you like, you know, you don't have the bump, you know, you don't have like, you don't have any kind of direct tissue in terms of saying, all right, look, clearly Harvey was involved. So, I mean, how it's going to play out is just like unbelievable. And like, it's this case that, because as soon as she's convicted, if she is, people are going to be calling for Wendy's head, you know? And it's like, it's going to be one of those situations where people are going to be dying to know if George is going to make the move, you know, but she's got to weigh the evidence. She needs to look and see, do I have enough? I've got some stuff between Jeff Lacoste, who was, you know, Wendy's ex-boyfriend, who said some pretty damning shit. And, you know, you've got Wendy's location at the time of the murders. And then you've got common sense, you know, that where people are like, all right, man. I mean, is it, you know, but like I would be using, if I was defending Wendy, I'd be using the emails of Donna's as evidence for Wendy that like, look, Wendy, depending on what the reply was, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, that's like, a big question.
Depending on whatever, however Wendy replied to those emails, like, mom, fuck off, leave me alone. Or like, I hear you, mom. And,
sounds
you know,
like a great idea. I'll do whatever you're going to do. I'll be over here.
Yeah. Like those aren't helpful to Wendy. So I mean, it's all fascinating, man. It's such a tangled web, man. It's crazy.
It's going to be fascinating. I know you guys are covering it over on Defense Diaries. We're going to be running it over here as well. And of course, we'll be talking about it for the next several weeks, I'm sure.
Indeed we will.
Bob Mata, Defense Diaries, as always, thank you so much for giving us your insight on this case.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com. This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.